Alright, tonight we are in part two of our series, The Bible from 20,000 Feet. We're slowly gaining altitude in the first few chapters of Genesis. We're going to look at chapters 6 through 11. And at the top of your notes there is an outline that kind of gives a breakdown of the key points we're going to look at. We're going to first look at Noah, who is a type of Christ. Then the flood and the ark, which is a type of salvation. Then we're going to be looking at the meaning of the rainbow, the profound meaning of the rainbow, and God's promise to preserve the world after the flood, and then the repopulation of the earth after the flood. So starting off with Noah as a type of Christ in Genesis chapter 6, and the conditions that led to the flood, and God's call upon Noah's life. In chapter 5, we looked at the genealogy that kind of gave a breakdown or an overview of the immediate descendants of Noah, or of Adam. And then in chapter 6, we see, you know, generations later, we see pretty much the direction that mankind went. You know, mankind quickly just degenerated and went down a bad path. From the fall, you know, the initial fall, to just continued sliding downhill. We read in Genesis chapter 6, verses 5 through 8, "Then the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually." So mankind is just plagued with sin, you know, that began in the garden. "And the Lord was sorry that he had made man on the earth, and he was grieved in his heart. So the Lord said, 'I will destroy man whom I have created from the face of the earth, both man and beast, creeping thing and birds of the air, for I am sorry that I have made them.'" And then in verse 8 we read, "But Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord." Now one little thing to point out here is that if you really think about it, the wickedness of man after the flood was really no different than before the flood. It's just the state of mankind's heart. We read in Jeremiah 17:9 that the heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it? So the flood didn't really change anything in the heart of man. But one thing it did do is it made clear the fate of mankind without God's intervention, without his plan of salvation. It's a little snapshot in history where we see that without salvation, the human race would be over. God's judgment would destroy the whole human race. It's only by his grace that things continue. It also shows and points out that God is in absolute control. It's not like the world's out of his control and he has no choice but to try to save us because he can't stop it. You know, he could stop the world at any time, but he's chosen to provide salvation by grace. So Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. The covenant God made in the beginning of Genesis with Adam, when he said that the seed of the woman would defeat Satan, that was basically a prophecy of Christ, as we looked at how seed of the woman is only found one time in the Bible. Normally one's descendants is seed of the man. But that was a prophecy of the virgin birth of Christ and a declaration from God that one would come, the Messiah would come, who would defeat Satan. So that covenant that God made there with Adam is established through Noah. It's preserved through Noah. As he says there in verses 17 through 18 of Genesis 6, "And behold, I myself am bringing floodwaters on the earth to destroy from under heaven all flesh in which is the breath of life. Everything that is on the earth shall die. But I will establish my covenant with you, Noah, and you shall go into the ark, you, your sons, your wife, and your sons' wives with you. Another key point here in Noah's life, and really the main point of this section, is that he is a type of Christ. In a couple of ways. First of all, one striking point in his life that points to the gospel is how during the fall, the entire human race being plunged into the fall was hinged on the life of one person. What one person did caused the whole human race to fall. It was like a spiritual law that caused that. And it might seem unfair, it might not make sense, but it's just the nature of the human race. Adam, the figurehead of the human race, caused the whole race to go into the fall. It was what one person did. And here in Noah's life, we see what one person doing, saving the whole world. If Adam, this one person, did not build the ark, then the whole human race would have perished. History came to the point where the preservation of the human race was dependent on what one person did. Now, of course, because God had already made a covenant that he would provide salvation and defeat Satan, if it wasn't Noah, it would have been somebody else. I mean, God would have sovereignly raised up somebody else because he keeps his word, and he had to fulfill that initial covenant. But Noah was the one he chose. So the fall hinging on one person, preservation of the world hinging on what one person did, which was a foreshadow of ultimately salvation for the whole world hinging on what one person does, hinging on what Christ did on the cross. And the book of Romans actually points out that parallel in chapter 5. Therefore, as through one man's offense, judgment came to all men, resulting in condemnation, even so, through one man's righteous act, the free gift came to all men, resulting in justification of life. So, that contrast, through one man's offense, through one man's righteous act, the fall and salvation hinging on those two people. And Noah, his righteous life, the preservation being dependent on him, foreshadowing Christ. And then in verse 19, continues in chapter 5 there of Romans, for as by one man's disobedience many were made sinners, so also by one man's obedience many will be made righteous. And another layer of symbolism there in Noah's life is just the righteous character of his life. If Noah didn't lead a righteous life, he wouldn't have been able to fulfill his role of building the ark and providing a way for the human race to continue. And again, if it wasn't him, God could have raised up somebody else, but his qualification was living a righteous life. As God says there in Genesis 7, verse 1 through 2, then the Lord said to Noah, come into the ark, you and all your household, because I have seen that you are righteous before me in this generation. And of course, Christ lived a perfectly righteous life. Without the righteousness of Christ, without him being perfectly righteous, he would not have been able to bear our sins and die in our place and provide our salvation. If Noah didn't live a righteous life, he would not have been able to build the ark and fulfill that role to provide a way for the world to be saved. And of course, there is an infinite gap between the righteousness of Noah and Christ, just relative to the rest of the world. Noah lived a righteous life. And the key to living that righteous life for Noah and also for us is faith. And the faith in Noah's faith is really what set him apart. The righteousness was just a byproduct of that faith. When we live in an intimate relationship with God through faith, our life naturally reflects that relationship and has a righteous character to it. Verses 9 through 10 there in chapter 6 point to Noah's relationship with God when it says, "Now Noah was a righteous man, blameless among the people of his time, and he walked with God." He walked in relationship to the faith. An example of Noah's faith is simply the ark. It took great faith to build that ark in the midst of many people making fun of him, no doubt. You know, imagine what that would look like. This man building this massive ark and saying that the world's going to flood. Sure, that was total faith. So, backing up a little bit, this central theme in our whole journey through the Old Testament is going to be how the entire Old Testament points to Christ. There's these links of God's plan of salvation. Last week we saw the first link there in the Garden of Eden when God made a covenant, made a promise that through the offspring of Adam and Eve, one would come to defeat and overthrow the work of Satan. That was the first mention of the gospel, the first link. Actually, the first link was when God made coverings for Adam and Eve, when God killed an animal to make coverings out of animal skin. That was something God did for them. God made that covering. Adam and Eve didn't make it. God made it. The first blood which shed was a result of making coverings for Adam and Eve, which pointed to the blood of Christ being shed to cover our sins. But that was the first link. Then the covenant to defeat the work of Satan. And now we see another link, the whole world being preserved through God's grace, working through one man. Without that preservation, those promised, that covenant, could not be fulfilled. And all throughout the Old Testament, you see link after link after link, all pointing to the cross. And the foreshadow of the cross becoming more and more clear in the Garden of Eden with blood being shed to make coverings for Adam and Eve's nakedness, very abstract, faint foreshadow. But the seed of the woman, the promise that he would defeat Satan, a little more clarity. And as we go, there's going to be more and more clarity, especially in Abraham's life. Next week we're going to look at, there's a bunch of links in his life. More and more light and clarity until the gospel, until Christ came in clear view. So the next key point is the ark being a type of salvation. So Noah builds this ark by faith, and then in chapter 7, in verse 6, we read, "Noah was 600 years old when the floodwaters came on the earth. And Noah and his sons and his wife and his sons' wives entered the ark to escape the waters of the flood. Pairs of clean and unclean animals, of birds and all creatures that move along the ground, male and female, came to Noah and entered the ark, as God had commanded Noah. And after 7 days the flood waters came on the earth. In the 600th year of Noah's life, on the 17th day of the second month, on that day all the springs of the great deep burst forth, and the floodgates of the heavens were opened. And rain fell on the earth 40 days and 40 nights. One common misconception, I think, is that, you know, a lot of people might look at the flood and think, yeah, that's impossible. How could 40 days of rain cover the earth? And that would have been impossible. I don't think 4,000 years of rain would cover the earth. But there's two other sources of water there. It says that the floodgates of heaven were opened, and springs of the great deep burst forth. So there were profound geographical changes that happened. It seems to indicate that there were huge reservoirs of water down deep in the earth, and then reservoirs of water in the atmosphere, perhaps an ice canopy or something, some people have conjectured, that just created this massive deluge suddenly, just a sudden flood. And then as that flood happened, a picture of God's wrath, Adam or Noah and his family were sheltered. They were sheltered from the flood in the ark and preserved. 1 Thessalonians 1:10 states that Jesus delivers us from the wrath to come. So in a sense, Jesus is an ark. He's the ark of salvation. Through him we're protected, we're shielded from God's wrath. Jesus delivers us from the wrath to come, which probably refers to the Great Tribulation. You know, it seems reasonable to conclude that we'll be raptured before the Great Tribulation. That'll be like an ark protecting us from that massive destruction on the earth. And ultimately the lake of fire in eternity. That's the ultimate outpouring of God's wrath on sin. And through Christ, we're delivered from that. And as we, through faith, depend on Christ and live for him, in many ways we're like Noah. The world looks at us and mocks and thinks, why do you need Christ? Why do you need to build that ark? Something the world makes fun of. But one day, just as the floodwaters came, God's wrath will come in different stages. The Great Tribulation, and ultimately in eternity. And only through Christ do we have salvation from that. Next main point is the meaning of the rainbow and God's covenant to preserve the world after the flood. As we read in Jeremiah 17:9, the heart is desperately wicked. And who can know it? It was that way before the flood and after the flood. So if God brought the flood to destroy all of the population because of wickedness and sin, one might think that, well, if he did that before the flood, what's to say he might not bring another flood? Because the same conditions exist. We're just as wicked as we were before. But the reason we know he's not going to bring another flood is because of this covenant he makes here in Genesis chapter 8, where he says in verse 21, I will never again curse the ground for man's sake, although the imagination of man's heart is evil from his youth. So even though he's just as evil, I will never again bring the flood. Nor will I again destroy every living thing as I have done. While the earth remains, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, winter and summer, and day and night shall not cease. Now, one key little point there is, while the earth remains, there will come a day when God will completely destroy the earth and make a new earth. But until that day, never again will he completely wipe out the population as he did during the flood. And again, this is another link in the plan of salvation. The reason he's going to preserve the world, another link here, is because that preservation is basically opening up a window for salvation. In that window of preservation, his plan of salvation is completed. And opportunity for everyone to be saved is made possible. And something that we take for granted, but the rainbow, a common sight that we see every winter, or whenever it rains, often when it rains, the rainbow is actually a God-given sign about that preservation. This beautiful arc of color in the sky that we see is a monument to God's promise to preserve the world, a monument to the window of salvation God has opened for the world. It's existed ever since the flood. It's kind of like an artifact, a monument that's been there since the flood, an ancient monument in the sky. It's kind of neat to think of it like that.
One of the seven wonders of the world.
Yeah.
Something like that.
But there in Genesis chapter 9, verse 12 through 16, God said, "This is the sign of the covenant I am making between me and you and every living creature with you, a covenant for all generations to come. I have set my rainbow in the clouds, and it will be the sign of the covenant between me and the earth. Whenever I bring clouds over the earth and the rainbow appears in the clouds, I will remember my covenant between me and you and all living creatures of every kind. Never again will the waters become a flood to destroy all life," because he has a plan of salvation, a window of opportunity for salvation that will be fulfilled and completed. Nothing will stop it. In Acts chapter 17, verse 23 through 27, basically states how God has arranged history and ordered history to provide opportunity for salvation for all people. The purpose of history, in the words of verse 27, is that so that they should seek the Lord and hope that they might grope for him and find him, though he is not far from each one of us. So again, as we talked about last week, Genesis and the whole Old Testament, the whole Bible, it's not meant to be an exhaustive almanac of everything that happened, but it's meant to preserve and tell us key details. And as we've already seen here, in the first 11 chapters of Genesis, we see all these key links in the plan of salvation. That's the purpose of Genesis, is to give us an overview and of key facts. It's not meant to tell us every little detail of how God made the world and how the earth was destroyed with the flood and what it looked like before the flood, and you know, it's just, there's an economy of words here to give us key details. But at this point, one thing that's a subtle thing but important to point out is that we've only looked at 11 chapters. There's over 1,000 chapters in the Bible. I believe there's 1,198 to be exact, or 1,189. And just in these first 11 chapters, we've already seen the key central themes of the whole Bible. Imagine a person in the jungle who's never heard the gospel, never had come in contact with the Bible. Their whole worldview is based on mythology, kind of, or even the Greek mythology, before much of the Roman world had heard the gospel and the message of the Bible. The ideas of God and our destiny and where we came from were outlandish, bizarre mythologies. Just when we read it today, it sounds crazy, but that was the wisdom of the day, the common conceptions. And similar ideas prevail, I'm sure, today in jungles where people haven't come in contact with the message of the Bible. But going from knowing nothing to, there's a contrast here I want you to kind of picture. Picture the contrast between going from knowing absolutely nothing about the Bible to having an overview of the whole Bible. That's like night and day. It's a huge gap, a huge, profound quantum leap in understanding. Then imagine only having the first 11 chapters of the Bible, of Genesis, which has been around for, well, ever since Moses wrote it, probably around 1400 BC, but the information there has been around since the flood, since ancient times. Imagine the contrast between knowing nothing and having an overview of the whole Bible, and the contrast of that with knowing only the first 11 chapters compared to knowing the whole Bible. The change from understanding of the first 11 chapters to the whole Bible is much, much smaller step than if you knew nothing, because the central themes are there. And, you know, what are some of those central themes? We see a problem. One of the first great revelations is that there is a problem in the human race. It's the problem of sin. You know, without that revelation, we might think everything's okay. We might think that we're gods in the making and that we have everything we need for eternal life. But the Bible reveals there's a profound problem that needs to be resolved. We see that. We see, you know, the problem being the fall, sin, the fall in the garden, death, the flood, signs that something's majorly wrong in the human race. And then the solution. We see God providing a covering for Adam and Eve, God intervening. You know, even that's a revelation, that God would intervene and provide salvation. God preserving the human race through the flood, during the flood, the covenants he's made, the covenant that the Messiah would defeat Satan. Profound revelations just in the first 11 chapters. And then the result of that, the result of the problem followed by the solution, is the lives of the saints. Lives that are characterized by righteousness and faith. And also failings and God's grace meeting them in those failings. Now, even though Noah was a righteous man, still he was a sinner like everybody else. And we see an example of some of his failings in chapter 9, where he gets drunk, that whole episode. But a problem, solution, and the result. Living a righteous life by faith and depending on God's grace. All of that's there in the first 11 chapters. And that's the essence of the whole Bible. So, again, I kind of think of it as millipede theology. The critics, and even if the critics were able to cut out half the Bible, the essence would still be there. Like if you cut a millipede in half, it still can live and crawl. Cut it into four, and I'm not sure how much can be cut, but certain millipedes or worms can lose half their body and still crawl. And that's how the Bible is. The Bible could lose 1,189 chapters and only have 11 chapters, and not much would change. The essence is still there. It's just through the whole Bible we see more and more detail and insights and layers and the final completion of that plan. Fast forwarding now, many generations after the flood, we see the Tower of Babel there in chapter 11. I think often when we think of the Tower of Babel, we think of another incident of God's wrath. But in reality, the Tower of Babel is actually an act of grace, where God confused the languages and spread out the whole population. In reality, it was an act of grace, an act of preservation, an act, following his promise to preserve the world. Because without God confusing the languages, what was happening there at the Tower of Babel was there was one language which allowed for unprecedented collaboration for technological development. And the Tower of Babel was essentially the fruit of technological development. And so with that accelerated pace of technological development, if God hadn't confused the languages and spread out the whole population, they probably would have been on the moon by the time Christ was born. They probably would have had automobiles in his day. It's probable, because that technology would have accelerated so fast, but God, in effect, slowed the progress of technology to act as an agent of preservation. Because I think it's reasonable to conclude that if God hadn't done that, the human race would have self-destructed long ago, before his plan of salvation would have had a chance to be completed. So So it's just another act of preservation, another act of grace. Then in chapter 10 and the second half of chapter 11, we see another two sets of two more genealogies there. In chapter 10, basically gives an overview of 70 different people that descended from Noah, descended from the descendants of Noah's three sons. There's 70 people listed because those 70 people pretty much cover the whole population, all the different nations that descended from Noah, different regions of the earth. Of course, 70 is symbolic of completeness, so it was a complete list. It was not an exhaustive list, but it's just a complete overview that covers all regions. So in Genesis chapter 5, we had a genealogy from Adam to Noah, and here in chapter 10, from Noah to Abraham. So, again, you know, paralleling this, the lengths of God's plan of salvation, the genealogy is just another layer there. The promise that the seed of the woman, the seed of the descendants of Adam and Eve, would defeat Satan. So this genealogy is the link from Adam and Eve all the way to Christ. The genealogy in Genesis chapter 5 and Genesis chapter 10 parallel the genealogy in Luke. You know, you've got that long genealogy in Luke, and these are just two segments in that genealogy. And as history progresses, we'll have more and more segments added until that genealogy is complete. So chapter 10 gives a broad overview. Chapter 11 actually narrows it down and focuses solely on the messianic line. There's a little bit of overlap between the two chapters, but chapter 10 ends at Peleg, a descendant of Noah, Peleg. But chapter 11 goes beyond Peleg all the way to Abraham. You have Noah, Shem, Arphaxad, Shelah, Eber, Peleg, Reuben, Serug, Nahor, Terah, and Abraham, who later became Abraham. Another important point here is, in the genealogy of Christ, is that it's a selective genealogy. In ancient times, the custom was not to include every single name, but only key names. There are two clues here we have that reveal that it is selective. In the Gospel of Luke, between Arphaxad and Shelah, a person by the name of Canaan is listed. But here in Genesis chapter 10 and 11, that name is missing. So one might think, well, that's an error. There's an example of an error. But in reality, it's probably just the custom of not including all names. Because the gospel the genealogy in Luke chapter 3 is actually from the Septuagint. It's from the Greek translation of the Old Testament. So when those 70 scholars in Alexandria, Egypt, around 200 BC, got together to translate the Hebrew Old Testament into the Greek and analyze that genealogy, for some reason they chose to add one more name in this selective genealogy that was not in the original Hebrew. And our Old Testament here is from the original Hebrew, so that's why there's that discrepancy. Another clue that it's selective would be the ages given in chapter 11. If you lay out those different ages, there'd be an inconsistency, because by the time of Abraham, if that genealogy was not selective, then at the time of Abraham, according to the dates given in chapter 11, all of his ancestors would have been living, which doesn't make any sense. So it's in line with the custom of the day, it's a selective genealogy. So next week we'll be picking up with the life of Abraham, a major link in the long chain of the plan of salvation. Foreshadow of Christ will get even brighter. That's our study. Any questions or...